From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. On today's program, the dark and comic radio drama of Joe Frank. Listening to a Joe Frank drama can be as compelling as, say, hearing the private thoughts of your ex-lover or eavesdropping on the telephone conversations of people going off the deep end. Also today, I speak with composers Philip Johnston and Joel Forrester. They write loopy, infectious, idiosyncratic music for their group, the Microscopic Septet. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of the Czech Philharmonic Orchestra performing Smetana's Mavlost, or My Country. And critic Ken Tucker reviews a new video of old Milton Berle television shows. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The Wall Street Journal called Joe Frank radio's Prince of Darkness, and the L.A. Times described his program as radio noir. Joe Frank is the creator, writer, and director of a radio drama series called Work in Progress. It's heard on many public radio stations around the country. It's produced at KCRW in Santa Monica and distributed by NPR. On the radio, Frank dwells on loneliness, despair, suicide, madness, sexual fear, and sexual obsession. He manages to find the absurdity in his grim subject matter, so most of his programs are funny while still being quite disturbing. If you're a long-time public radio listener, you might remember Joe Frank's early work from the late 70s. He started in radio in his late 30s after ending a teaching career. Joe Frank's series, Work in Progress, sometimes takes the form of a Joe Frank monologue, but often he works with actors. The stories range from autobiography to pure fantasy to stories he solicits about other people's lives. Before we meet Joe Frank, let's get started with an excerpt of Frank's program, Rent a Family. In this scene, Eleanor phones her ex-husband Arthur, who is remarried. This is one of a series of desperate calls she's made, and Arthur has begged her to stop calling.
Hello, may I speak to Arthur, please?
Eleanor, this has got to stop. This can't go on. Surely you're aware of that.
May I speak to Arthur, please?
Eleanor, listen, I understand what you are going through, but what you've got to know is that it's not working. None of what you are doing is working.
May I speak to Arthur, please?
Okay. Arthur!
What is it?
Arthur, I've been thinking.
Yeah, what?
I would like to come and visit with you and Kathy for a while. Now hear me out. I won't be any trouble. I can do all the things that I'm sure Kathy has no time to do because she has her job, and I can cook nice things for you both, and I can clean the house, and I can do the gardening, and I can take care of all of the little things that you don't have time to do or that you don't like to do, you know, Arthur, those things. And I'll stay out of your way. I won't say a word if I'm not. I'll be sort of a housekeeper, a silent housekeeper. See, the thing is that I need a family, Arthur.
Eleanor. Imagine that the three of us could share share a house together.
But you don't understand. I could do all kinds of things for you. I could clean the house. I could keep the garden beautiful. And your life would be so much easier. Don't you understand? It would be...
What you're suggesting is bizarre.
Why?
It is absurd.
It could work. It could. It could.
An excerpt of Rent a Family, written and directed by my guest, Joe Frank, from his series Work in Progress, which is produced at public radio station KCRW in Santa Monica and is carried on many public radio stations around the country. Joe Frank, what's really eerie about that tape is how real it sounds. I'm usually not a really big, real big fan of radio drama because there's something about it that sounds very phony and actorly a lot of the time. And these sound like real phone conversations, real scary ones.
Well, I agree with you entirely about radio drama, and I've never been able to listen to radio drama and believe in the credibility of the performances, and I'm always distanced from it, and it does seem artificial to me. And so the approach that I've taken in all the dramas that I've created is that, in fact, they're not written. It's not accurate to say it was written by Joe Frank, because these are improvisations performed by actors, which are very carefully directed. And what this involves is a great deal of editing, because you do the telephone calls over and over again, and then I edit them in such a way that I hope creates a credible performance.
Well, sometimes you do tell your own story, and I want to play an excerpt of a show in which you did that. At least I assume it was your story. And the show is called No Show. And you want to explain what the show is about?
Well, No Show came out of an experience in which I came into the radio station unprepared to do a radio show. I had a horrendous week. Everything seemed to have gone wrong that week. I'd had no chance to write or to work on creating a radio program, and so I decided, since I had to go on the air and there was no way of avoiding it, that I would simply explain to my listening audience why I had no show prepared.
And one of the many reasons why you had no show, in addition to having been out with a friend till 4 a.m, having a sick cat, having a lonely friend come over in spite of your asking her not to, you were invited to a dinner party and you had to go. And this is the part of your program, No Show, in which you talked about that dinner party, which prevented you from producing your program that week.
Well, the dinner party that I attended began with a group of people sitting and talking in the parlor living room of a woman's house, of the hostess who had invited us all, eating caviar and sour cream, liverwurst spread and cheese on crackers. And there was a table with a row of wine bottles and some glasses on it. I was compulsively eating the crackers and the cheeses and drinking wine, wishing that I could wake up from this dream, be back alone in my hotel room. But I was also thinking, this is good for you, this is good for you. Get out, meet people, you could learn something. This will be nourishing, maybe you can get some good material out of it. But, you know, it's hard to be a gatherer of material when you find yourself periodically tuning out to what's going on, when you lose track of the conversation, when you suddenly find yourself on Dream Street. You don't have the faintest notion of what anybody is saying, of what's being discussed. You're thousands of miles away. It's like the other people there are on television, their characters in a sitcom with the volume turned off. And you can see them gesturing and talking and laughing, but you can't hear anything. And you're thinking of nothing. Your mind is in brownout. And yet I was painfully aware of the fact that, to some extent, I was on trial. The party was being given, I was told, to my chagrin, in my honor. And everyone else here, I figured, were members of the jury. You know, they were all being very nice and they were being pleasant, but I knew that at the end of the evening, when they were walking and driving home with their friends, with their lovers, with their wives, they would discuss how the evening went, and my name eventually would come up at some point, and they'd say something like, "He seems so intelligent, so outgoing on the air, but really he's rather disappointing, don't you think?" George was so much funnier. George was so much cleverer. He was so much faster on his feet than Joe Frank was. I mean, did the man say one arresting thing all evening? No, he just sat there listening, laughing at what other people said, trying to avoid the limelight for all he was worth. He's obviously typical of so many performers, shy, neurotically withdrawn.
Joe Frank, an excerpt of his program Work in Progress, which is heard on many public radio stations around the country. Joe, do you really make pacts with yourself to never go out again?
Well, I don't go out, or I very rarely go out, and I certainly haven't been to a dinner party since the one that I described, and that was at least a year ago. Yes, I remember that party well, and I'm pretty much a loner and pretty much work obsessed, and spend most of my time working or thinking about the work that I'm doing.
Let me ask you about the work obsession. You have to eliminate a lot of, quote, real life to stay home all the time and obsess on your work. Do you think that that kind of real life is sometimes overrated? Is it filled with stuff that you don't much enjoy anyways?
No, I think I've been caught in a paradox, really, because in order to be able to create compelling radio programs, you have to have some experiences to base, you know, those programs on. And if you live the kind of life that I've been living recently, you're not living yourself. You're just you're not gathering material from your own life. So what I have done recently, although I'm going to change that very soon, is I have drawn on the experiences of others. I interview people, I talk to people, people come to me with their stories, and we'll sit late at night for hours in my apartment with a tape recorder rolling, and then on the basis of that extended interview, and some of these interviews will go on for days, radio programs will be created. But I'm beginning to find this approach too parasitic and not that personally satisfying, so I'm going to go out and begin to live as a normal human being, or maybe an abnormal human being, in order to gather my own material, and sort of create experiences for my radio program out of my own life, as opposed to drawing from other people's lives.
Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of your more personal shows deal with fears and insecurities, ones that, you know, we can all relate to. But I wonder if when you take your own insecurities and put them in a kind of persona and make them into an hour radio program, if they're easier to deal with than they are, say, when you're lying awake alone in the middle of the night.
Oh, yeah. As a matter of fact, by using those experiences for radio programs, you transcend them. You almost look for bad experiences or painful experiences. Whatever tragedies might befall you, you can always right away think, well, that would make a great story for radio. And so that whatever happens, even if it has a great negative content, even if it's painful, because you can then tell it on the radio and share it with many listeners and move people or entertain people, it then takes on a positive value. And I remember distinctly that coming to that revelation a number of years ago, when I realized that I no longer that I no longer wanted to avoid pain, that I could use it in a way that was very productive. So that it was easier to experience whatever suffering that came my way.
Well, we have some more of your work that I'd like to play for our listeners, but first we're going to take a short break. My guest is Joe Frank, who does a very unusual, very funny, and sometimes very morbid and surrealistic radio show that comes from KCRW and is broadcast on many public radio stations around the country. It's called Work in Progress. We'll hear more from it after this short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Joe Frank, and I want to play another excerpt from one of your shows. And this is from a program that you did called Let Me Not Dream. And for this show, you called a lot of your ex-lovers. And explain what this was about.
Well, it just occurred to me that it might be amusing and entertaining, and I'm constantly driven by the desire to do something that has never been done before on the radio, or to surprise and astonish and amaze my listeners, just to kind of press the limits as far as I can carry them or press them. And one thing that had occurred to me was to call up all my former lovers and girlfriends. And it was 11 o'clock in Los Angeles, and they were all living on the East Coast, because that's where I was originally from. So it was late at night in New York and Washington, D.C., which was where they all lived. And I called one after another, after another, after another, and woke up most of them up, and just told them that I was calling them live on the air, and engaged them in conversation. And at the end of each conversation, I sang the song, I Remember You.
Let's hear an excerpt of this program.
Hello?
Hello, Amy?
Joe?
Yeah.
Hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm fast asleep.
Well, I guess I, your time, it's probably 2:30 now. Do you know what I'm doing?
You just finished your show?
No, my show is still on.
Oh.
Do you know what that means?
Am I on the air?
That's right, you're on the air now.
Oh, I'm glad I'm so sleepy.
That's all right, I just want to sing you a song.
You do?
Yeah. You can sing with me if you want to.
Uh-oh.
You ready?
Mm-hmm.
Here we go. I remember you. You're the one who made my dreams come true. A few kisses ago. You can sing along if you want to. I remember you. You're the one who said, I love you too. I do. Didn't you know? I remember too what distant bells. I remember too what distant bells. And stars that fell. And stars that fell. Like rain out of the blue. Like rain out of the blue. When my life is through. And the angels ask me to recall the thrill of them all. Then I shall tell them I remember you. I'm gonna go away now.
Was that just for me?
That was just for you.
Oh, that's sweet.
Good night.
Good night, Joe.
Well, Joe Frank, I think that was really funny and really cruel. I think that's one of the weirdest pieces of tape I've heard. Don't you think it's a little cruel calling up all... Wait, let me just run through the ways. Calling up old girlfriends, waking them up because it's 2:30 their time, singing a song they don't know and asking them to sing along, and then telling them... leading them to believe that they're the only one that you've called to sing I Remember You too.
I feel guilty about that program. On that, you know, very often when you do what I do, you...
sell out a friend for a program.
That's... Well, I must say that she was the only one who asked me, did you just do this for me? So I only had to lie once. It's true, it was... There was cruelty in doing that, and I sometimes question myself about that particular program. In fact, Let Me Not Dream I didn't repeat it. I could have repeated it recently on KCRW at a certain point, when and I didn't want to do it because I feel uncomfortable with that show. However, on the other hand, it's a program that generated tremendous listener response. People loved it, and I got lots of letters and phone calls and people who wanted cassette copies of the show because they thought it was so amusing and entertaining and original. So you're kind of torn between doing things that that may not be very nice sometimes, but make really extraordinary radio.
I want to play one final piece of tape, and this is an excerpt of a program that you did called Tour of the City, and this is the Suicide Bridge part. Would you introduce it for us?
The scene at the Suicide Bridge is introduced by a taxi driver who is driving me, giving me a sort of a tour of the city, and he approaches a structure called the Waterworks Bridge, where people very pleasantly and very positively and enthusiastically kill themselves.
This is a favorite place to commit suicide, because this is where, before the water goes into the purification plant, the acid content of the water is very high, and when the body hits the water, it dissolves on contact. And so it's very painless, and most of the people who want to commit suicide jump off right here into Waterworks Gorge. The lines are very long. They're always very long. Sometimes people complain because the lines are so long and they have to live for so long before they can jump. Sometimes people leave and discover that they'd prefer to live while they're standing waiting. But most times people will wait because the idea of ending it all is so exciting and important to them. And you see that lady just dived in. She did a double half-gainer with a full twist. That's a very nice last dive that got good applause. Many people have a special way of ending it all, making the final finale, so to speak. They practice and they conceive a special dive, and everybody likes it, and they applaud, and that makes everybody feel good before they go. Oops. See, then she goes into the water and she dissolves immediately.
An excerpt from Tour of the City, which was conceived and directed by my guest, Joe Frank, who's a radio dramatist and performer, and his nationally distributed series is called Work in Progress. You know, so many of your programs over the years have dealt with despair, loneliness, murder, suicide, and it's always led
many,
me to
many,
what, yeah.
Many uplifting experiences.
That's right.
I just wanted to.
So let me ask you a few just blunt questions, if you don't mind. Have you ever come close to death yourself?
Yes, I have.
When? How?
Through illness that I'd rather not elaborate and discuss. But yes, I have. And I've also, I've you know, I think, as everyone has, I've sometimes thought about suicide, and but more than that, I've thought about wanted. I remember it not recently, but when I was growing up, wanting to die for something, wanting to give my life for something. Unfortunately, I never could find out what it was that I wanted to give my life for. There didn't seem to be anything that, if only I had been able to find something to sacrifice my life for. I may not, in fact, be talking to you right now, but I never could find it.
You know, the themes that we're talking about here are very dark, but your programs are usually, or frequently, comedies.
Yeah.
There are a lot of dark things that you've experienced in your life. Your parents fled Europe during World War II, fled the Nazis.
Yeah.
You wore braces when you were young. You had club feet, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Did any of this seem funny at all to you? Were you able to find the absurd or comic side of these things when you were young, when you were experiencing it?
No, not when I was experiencing it. When I was experiencing it, it seemed unrelievably dark and tragic. Not only did we come out of the Holocaust, and not only was I crippled as a child, but my father was also dying when I was a child and died when I was 5 years old. And when I was going through it, it was just painful and dark and miserable. But I think somewhere I developed a way of, maybe what happened then was I distanced myself from those experiences in some way. And I certainly think that the humor, the way I've combined humor and pathos and humor and tragedy in the same, many times in the same program. For example, Rent a Family, which we heard earlier, we heard a very dark and quite serious moment, but it's also a comedy. That's a way of distancing myself from these experiences by seeing them as absurdist or strange or in some way surreal and comic.
You are getting into performing in person now. Performing in performance spaces instead of just on the radio where you're invisible. And I wonder what it's been like for you to actually, you know, have a body in front of the people who you're talking to. I find myself that I frequently feel when I meet listeners that I'm disappointing them. You know, that they've imagined somebody in their mind and that there they are, there you are, the real person, and that you're not necessarily going to measure up to who they imagined you were. You know, do you ever feel that way?
Oh, absolutely. I feel that way when listeners come by the radio station, those avid, slavering, salivating fans with their eyes brightly shining, and they're looking for you, and then suddenly they see you, and you can see their expressions drop, and their hair seems to lose its luster, and and they seem suddenly deeply saddened by seeing you. But the performance that I've been doing at MoCA, the Museum of Contemporary Art in Los Angeles, is a different experience altogether, because in that case I'm actually in front of an audience of just about 200, and in that case I don't feel that particular experience, because I do a performance which is similar to the radio programs that I present, and the audience seems to enjoy it. But it's not how attractive you are. It's simply that people have a preconceived notion somehow of what you look like based on this voice that they've been listening to maybe for years. And whatever you look like, it's not going to be what they've imagined.
Well, Joe Frank, I wish you the best with your radio program, and thank you very much for talking with us and for playing some excerpts of it.
Thank you very much, Terry.
Joe Frank's radio show, Work in Progress, is heard on 25 public radio stations across the country. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, I'll speak with independent filmmaker Tony Buba. In his 15 films, Buba has documented the decline of his hometown, Braddock, Pennsylvania, a steel town outside of Pittsburgh. His latest film, Lightning Over Braddock, a Rust Bowl Fantasy, is a comedy that will shake up any preconceptions you may have about documentaries. I hope you can join us.
I remember you. You're the one who made my dreams come true.
You can sing along with me if you want to.
A few kisses ago.
Well, you can comment.
I remember you. You're the one who said I love you too. I do. Didn't you know?
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, the macroscopic world of the Microscopic Septet. They're a New York-based jazz group whose members have played in such diverse settings as New Wave, Top 40, Bebop, Free Improvisation, and Burlesque. We meet the Microscopic Septet's two main composers, pianist Joel Forrester and soprano saxophonist Philip Johnston. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of the Czech Philharmonic Orchestra performing Smetana's Mavlost, or My Country. And critic Ken Tucker looks at how well Milton Berle's now classic TV shows hold up on home video. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
This is Michael Richards. Jim Wright resigned today from his position as Speaker of the House and his seat in Congress amid allegations that he misused his authority. Wright defended himself against the charges today in a tearful speech on the floor of the House. He refuted the main points in the case against him and claimed he never knowingly broke the rules of the House. The most serious charges involve allegations that the Speaker used bulk sales of his book to get around outside income limits, and that he received $145,000 in benefits from a friend and business partner with an alleged direct interest in legislation before Congress. President Bush had kind words for the Speaker today, calling his tenure one of effectiveness and dedication. Wright says he'll remain in his position until a successor is chosen. President Bush arrived in London today after winning the applause of West Germans for his arms reduction proposals this week and for his remarks to an audience in Mainz. NPR's Jim Angle has the story.
President Bush touched every political nerve he could in a speech to a West German audience in Chancellor Kohl's home state today. He called for a less militarized Europe, which seemed more realistic this week after the president proposed sweeping cuts in combat troops and aircraft in Europe. And he embraced a cause close to the hearts of West Germans, a free and unified Europe. For 40 years, he said, the seeds of democracy in Eastern Europe lay dormant, frozen by the Cold War.
The world has waited long enough. The time is right. Let Europe be whole and free.
That, he said, is the new mission of NATO. Many West Germans had doubts about the Bush administration and the extent of its desire for arms control. Those doubts were greatly reduced this week. Even Foreign Minister Hans-Dietrich Genscher, who pushed a dispute with the U.S. over negotiating away short-range nuclear missiles, had praise for Mr. Bush. He called today's speech brilliant. It met all my expectations, he said. It gave a vision of a better Europe. I'm Jim Angle with the president in London.
Soviet Communist Party radical Boris Yeltsin today called for an annual plebiscite on the office of the president. He warned that the recent reforms have concentrated a dangerous amount of power into the hands of Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev. In a speech to the Congress of People's Deputies, broadcast live on Soviet television, Yeltsin said there should be a law to regulate the Communist Party. Yeltsin, a former Moscow party chief, also blamed Gorbachev for failing to pull the country out of a growing economic crisis. In Lebanon, Israeli warplanes have launched two bombing raids on Palestinian and pro-Iranian guerrilla bases. Witnesses said several people were killed, as Mike Theodulu reports from Nicosia, Cyprus.
In the first raid, four jets made three sweeping runs over the southern port city of Sidon, blasting a cluster of bases commanded by radical Palestinian groups, which are fiercely opposed to Yasser Arafat's peace initiatives with Israel. Among them were the Syrian-backed Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine and the extremist Fatah Revolutionary Council, which is led by Abu Nidal. In the other raid, six jets bombed positions of the pro-Iranian Hezbollah, or Party of God, in the Syrian-controlled Bekaa Valley. Both raids caused havoc. As ambulances rushed to evacuate casualties, guerrillas raced for their anti-aircraft guns, but the Israeli jets broke the sound barrier and were gone by the time they were heard by those below. Both raids were Israel's speedy answer to a spate of unsuccessful attempts by Arab gunmen to breach its northern border. For National Public Radio, I'm Mike Theodulu in Nicosia.
The Commerce Department today reported an 0.8% rise in the index of leading economic indicators in April. The increase followed consecutive declines in February and March. Many analysts say the figure suggests the economy is not headed for a recession. Stock prices were slightly higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average rose more than 4 points to close at 2480.15. Advances led declines 3-2 on a volume of 163 million shares. The average price of a share on the New York Exchange gained 14 cents. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Mav Lost, or My Country, is a cycle of six tone poems by Bedřich Smetana about the history, mythology, and landscape of his country, Bohemia. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz says it's also one of the great pieces of 19th century Czech nationalism. He has a review of a new live recording of the piece.
Ever since the end of World War II, the Czech Philharmonic Orchestra has performed Bedřich Smetana's Mav Lost at the opening of the annual Prague Spring Festival, each year under a different conductor. Last year, the honor went to Jiří Bělohlávek, the 43-year-old music director of the Prague Symphony. That live concert has been preserved on a new Supraphon compact disc. Maybe only someone who speaks Czech can capture the true inflections and dance rhythms of Smetana's moving masterpiece of national pride and determination. Mav Lost is actually a series of six thematically related tone poems written by Smetana towards the end of his career, between 1874 and 1879. During this period, Smetana was becoming completely deaf, the result of a syphilis infection. His country, Bohemia, now a part of Czechoslovakia, was still under the domination of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. Smetana wrote explicitly about the significance of these tone poems. They each depict a place or event of historical or cultural importance. The first section, for example, Vyšehrad, the High Castle, shows the rock that overlooks the Moldau River just outside of Prague. Traditionally, this was the seat of the ancient court of Bohemia. The tone poem begins with the harps of the ancient bards, about to spin out their legends of a heroic, independent, unconquered land. This movement ends, as Smetana explained, on a note of elegy. The second movement is the best known of the entire cycle, the Moldau. This music doesn't have to be nostalgic. The river still has its natural power. Its two streams, one cold, one warm, still join and flow together, past water spirits dancing in the moonlight, past a country wedding, over rapids, and through the great city of Prague, before vanishing in the distance. The third section, Sharka, presents the gory legend of the Czech Amazon women who massacre an entire army, a tale of victims who turn the tables. The fourth movement, from Bohemia's woods and fields, returns to a poetic landscape. With Smetana's stated approval, listeners can conjure up any image at all. The last two movements, Tabor and Blanik, tell the story of Jan Hus, the leader of the Czech Reformation movement, who was burned as a heretic in 1415. His followers, the Hussites, had their headquarters in the town of Tabor, and Blanik is the mountain where the defeated Hussite soldiers still lie in wait for the moment they can return to help their country. Both movements rely on the Hussite chorale, "Ye are the warriors of God." Smetana wrote that, quote, "On the basis of this melody will develop the resurrection of the Czech people, its future happiness and glory."
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor for the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new live recording of Smetana's Mavlast by the Czech Philharmonic Orchestra. It's on the Superfon label. This is Fresh Air. Often asked about the music we play between features on Fresh Air, the next interview is in part an answer to that question. One group whose music we play a lot is the Microscopic Septet. They're a jazz band whose members have each played in diverse settings, running the gamut from bebop to free jazz, new wave, top 40, and burlesque. John Zorn was the group's first alto saxophonist. The group was founded by my guests, pianist Joel Forrester and soprano saxophonist Philip Johnston. They're also the group's main composers. From the Microscopic Septet's latest disc, Beauty Based on Science, this is Forrester's composition, Off Color. You both meet?
Oh, it's...
That's a long story.
That's buried in time. All right, I'll tell my version of it, Philip. I was walking down, I believe it was St. Mark's Place, somewhere on the Lower East Side anyway, and I heard someone playing the Monk tune, Well, You Needn't, a saxophone player, playing that, and I'm a bit partial to that tune, and it sounded to me like he had got it right, so I decided to go up and visit this fellow, because you have to understand, Terry, it was the early 70s, you know, and even though Thelonious Monk was alive, his music was more honored in the breach, I think, than any other way. So I went upstairs of this walk-up apartment building, and I found the door was open, so I just went in, and the sax player was a polite young fellow, and he continued playing a little while and noted my presence and still kept playing, and then he turned to me and he said, "Oh, by the way, Nemo will be back in a while," and I said, "Who's Nemo?" So you see, that's sort of how we met.
Mm-hmm. What were the early reactions to the Microscopic Septet, and particularly to the sense of humor that you have in your pieces?
Well, actually, when we first started playing in New York, we really couldn't get a job in any jazz club in this town for that exact reason. People just thought we were too out to lunch, so we started going where the ears were, and we played at a lot of rock clubs. You know, people didn't know that it was jazz, and jazz wasn't that they didn't like jazz, so they just got tricked into liking it. And eventually, after a few years of not going away and making records and getting good reviews in Downbeat and stuff, the people in the jazz world started to realize that we were serious and that maybe they ought to check us out.
I think jazz criticism also underwent a sea change during those years.
Yeah, well, I think over the time, what we were doing, mixing different styles, became more accepted as a thing to do during that time. It seems to be the predominant musical wave at the moment, but at the time when we started doing it, it was looked upon as rather flippant, I believe.
Philip, I want to ask you about one of your compositions that's on your latest record, and that's the Waltz of the Recently Punished Catholic Schoolboys. Can you talk about this piece?
Basically, it's prompted by a vision that I had of young Catholic schoolboys in their uniforms suffering the anguish of remorse before the Virgin Mary, and being paddled with giant bronze rulers by nuns who are sort of a Burroughsian representative of the control virus. And then in their pain and suffering, experiencing a sort of mutual giant contact with each other. And the vision ends with all the Catholic schools with tears running down their faces, holding hands and floating through the sky.
Joel, in your brief bio that accompanies the microscopic...
The life is brief, too.
Yeah, that accompanies the microscopic press kit. It says that you received the personal encouragement of Thelonious Monk.
Yes, that's true.
What does that mean?
Well, what it means is that my own patron, the Baroness Pannoniker, who actually just died a few months ago, took me in hand about 12 or 13 years ago, took me out to... her strange palace in Weehawken, New Jersey, introduced me to Thelonious Monk in a serious way. And that's where he was lying in bed, not doing very much, lying in a full suit of clothes, mostly just thinking. He had a piano just outside his day room, and the Baroness would set me to playing that piano. And if Thelonious Monk liked what I was playing, he would open the door. And if he didn't, he would close the door. And I would play there for hours, playing my tunes and a few of his. It was wonderful criticism.
Oh, it must have been so interesting to be that physically close to someone like Monk, and yet
it was,
and yet he was such a kind of incommunicative recluse.
Yes, he was inviolate. It's true. There was, in a way, there was no getting directly close to him. But one time, I think the third time I played for him, he drew me into the room, and he told me very simply that he thought I could play. And that was enough. I've taken that as a sign.
Philip, is it hard to keep together a septet financially? I think a lot of jazz dates don't pay a lot of money, and when you're dividing that up among seven players, it must be hard to make a living from the septet.
Well, we don't make a living from the septet at this point, which is why everybody still freelances a lot and plays as sidemen in other people's bands and leads their own bands and does whatever they have to do to get by. But I wouldn't say the fact that we don't make that much money is not really a factor in us staying together. I mean, we've been together this long, and we've never really made any significant amount of money except for short periods of time. And it's something that I think we all look at as a long-term investment, so to speak.
What kind of commitment does each member have to the band, since the septet is always competing with each of the individual members' other gigs?
I think everybody in the band has had to suffer from time to time, Terry, you know, to bend himself to the group will, you know. I mean, it seems like every gig we have, there's somebody in the band who's got something hot happening at the same time, something with happening bread, some lure to call him away, you know. And then the band just, that man just has to change his mind. That's all. That's happened time after time.
Okay, I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Please do.
Thank you for having us, Terry.
Philip Johnston and Joel Forrester of the Microscopic Septet. Their upcoming performances include The Painted Bride in Philadelphia on June 17th and the JVC Festival in New York on June 29th. Here's more from their latest album, Beauty Based on Science, on Stash Records. This is Forrester's composition, Lobster in the Limelight. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is joining us to tell us what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. House Speaker Jim Wright has resigned from that job in Washington this afternoon. We'll have a report and reaction. Also, reaction from Britain to the Bush administration's arms control proposals of this week. A journalist goes riding the rails with Seattle Slim and Bear Grease riding freight cars. A trip from Mason City, Iowa to Spokane, Washington. And the Johnstown Flood. This is the centennial of that event, May 31st, 1889, in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. It was more an explosion than a flood. More than 2,000 people died. We'll hear a recreation of the way the flood sounded in Johnstown that afternoon.
Thanks, Noah. That and more coming up on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Many of the films that are considered classics have been released on video cassette, so we can see whether they hold up to contemporary viewing. But when it comes to the golden age of television, relatively little material is available on video. But now there's Milton Berle, The Second Time Around, a collection of three tapes that surveys the career of the man who in the late 40s became TV's first superstar. Critic Ken Tucker has this review.
If you're a post-baby boomer, it's difficult to imagine the kind of pop cultural impact that Milton Berle had. People loved his overweening vulgarity, the way he dressed in drag and walked on his ankles. Perhaps because it's been almost 30 years since his style was seen regularly, Berle sounds a little defensive in his introductions to these tapes, delivered in a room that's supposed to be his library of comedy.
You know, in 1948, when I made my debut on television, my style of comedy was raucous, brash, flippant, and aggressive. The sum total of everything in my books, right here, such as hokey costumes, wise guy put-downs, dressing in drag, I did anything for a laugh.
A lot of Berle's best seems hopelessly corny now, but it's also charming and interesting. Berle was a vaudeville-trained comic, an excellent physical comedian, and a fair talker. If there aren't many big laughs here, there are nice moments when the star interacts with guests like Frank Sinatra, Bob Hope, Martha Ray, and a pre-Sergeant Bilko, Phil Silvers. There's terrific footage of Cole Porter's only TV appearance and a wonderful segment in which Nat King Cole sits at a piano and dashes off his hits in an exceptionally witty medley. More typical of the jokiness, however, is this quick excerpt in which Berle joshes with Louis Armstrong.
Well, Satchmo, I want to tell you something. Whenever I hear you sing, I get a great feeling of your great talent whenever I hear you blow the trumpet that you were born, well, I mean, you're the top. You're the young man with the horn. I'm not kidding.
Thank you, Mr. Stevie. And you're my favorite. And you're the young man with the corn.
Even more intriguing for those of us too young to have seen them is this appearance by the team of Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis, who squawk and battle in front of Burl.
Listen to me!
Don't you stab your foot at me, Miriam.
I'm just as nasty as you. You don't have any consideration for me. I always get pushed around. You don't care that people's got feelings, that's all. I don't mind being a comedian and everything and taking the jokes, but I got feelings. I work hard and everybody knows that nobody on the ball of my
What are you laughing at? What are you laughing at? You're doing a show here, you're making...
Always picking an argument with
you. You're the one that's picking the argument.
The cliche is that Milton Berle is Mr. Television, but that title has a basis in fact. His Tuesday night variety show was widely credited with tripling the number of TV sets sold the first year it aired, and NBC signed him to an unprecedented 30-year contract. That sort of success is unheard of now, but you can get glimpses of what inspired it here and there on these tapes. Other new video cassette releases include Everybody's All-American, a 1988 film starring Dennis Quaid as a college football star who grows into a bitter middle-aged failure. Jessica Lange is the woman who stands by her man, except for one night when she stands by Timothy Hutton. The movie, directed by Taylor Hackford, is shamelessly sentimental, and it goes on way too long, but Jessica Lange is good, and Dennis Quaid is phenomenal. You believe him as a callow college kid, and when he ages into a tired, bloated man living off his golden youth, he seems at once pathetic and heroic. Watching Everybody's All-American gives you hope that Quaid can pull off his upcoming project, which sounds impossible, embodying Jerry Lee Lewis in the forthcoming Great Balls of Fire.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. For years, Hilma Wolitzer concentrated more on cooking and cleaning than on writing. Now she's a successful novelist. Her latest novel, Silver, is about a middle-aged couple caught between domestic complacency and individual self-fulfillment. On the next Fresh Air, Wolitzer discusses the conflicts in her characters' lives and in her own. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews new albums by Tin Machine, a band featuring David Bowie, and the Royal Crescent Mob, a band from Dayton, Ohio. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Dead Poets Society, starring Robin Williams, directed by Peter Weir, who also directed Witness. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet. Production assistance from Ed Doherty. Research assistance from Christopher Cook and Laura Civitz. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Lisa Bruton directed today's show. I'm Terry Gross. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.